Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. This week we visit the magnificently refurbished Baltimore Sailing Club in the heart of the historic maritime village and talk to the Commodore Joan Collins. Jerry Flynn has the detail on the latest edition of Inshore Ireland magazine. And as we celebrate the centenary of the Asgard, which this weekend, 100 years ago, sailed into Howth on the east coast of this island with a cargo of arms and munitions, with Erskine Childers, author of Riddle of the Sands, at the helm. Let's hear first from round-the-world yachtsman and maritime enthusiast Pat Murphy in Howth Yacht Club about the importance of the Asgard.
Six of us, under the leadership of Wally McGurk, decided we would take on the building of the replica. And I did the fundraising and raised the money from all the businesses, the clubs and the organisations in Howth and the surrounding areas. And we now have the dinghy, which you see is a lovely piece of workmanship. Larry Archer from North Dublin, he did the actual timber work on it. And it came into my workshop in Sutton, and myself and a chap called George Elliott, we spent hours and hours cleaning off all the rivets. There's 1,365 rivets on it. They were all sharp. We had to clean them all off. And then we started sanding and varnishing. There were about 8 coats of varnish on it. The oars were donated by Jerry Sargent, and Neville Maguire did lovely work on those. So it was a combined effort, but Wally McGurk was the main guy who pushed us into this whole project on Asgard from the beginning, way back in 2011.
So I see that some of the timbers in her are from the Asgard II that were left in Tyrrell's boatyard after she was completed in the 80s.
That's correct. The timber is a Colombian pine, and 90% of the timber used in the dinghy was the stuff that was left over from the building of Asgard II in Tyrrell's yard, and we were very lucky to be able to obtain that.
She's a very special piece of our maritime history, as is the Asgard herself, isn't she?
She is indeed. I mean, this goes back right to 1905 when Asgard was launched in Norway. And of course, Asgard, as we all know, was a wedding present from Molly Childers' parents in Boston on it. But Asgard's landing here in Howth, where we're standing now at the moment, in the 26th of July 1914, really was the whole beginning of this the Irish state, and it led up to 1916. So it's a very, very important date in Irish history. There was 1,500 Mauser 11 millimetre rifles were purchased from a Belgium arms dealer. They were German guns. And Asgard, together with Conor O'Brien's Kelpie, went down and collected these off a tug called the Gladiator off the Belgium coast on it. Asgard, Kelpie first of all collected 600 guns and ammunition, and the Asgard collected the balance of 900 guns and ammunition. And the whole story about the journey back and the conditions living on the boat with all these rifles and ammunition stored up to 2.5 feet high in the saloon, up in the forecastle, ammunition boxes.
We visit the RTÉ Radio Sound Archives next from July of 1961 as P.P. O'Reilly set the scene for listeners to Radio Éireann.
I think that the Asgard is not only the most historical boat in Irish waters now, but also one of the most beautiful. About an hour or so before the ceremonies began at Howth today, I saw her out there riding high in a very fresh breeze that had come up from the south and southwest, that was to bring up grey clouds but was to leave the sky clear for the sun to shine down on an historical and a rather touching ceremony. This is how it was. First of all, the scene. Crowds of people, the length of the pier and along that wonderful new prom that has been built at Howth. At sea, the corvette Mocha steaming away. And in the harbour, a true regatta, a regatta of boats of all kinds, many flying, enormous tricolours, others dressed, all moving around, so much so that the best view of the whole ceremony was from the harbour itself, from the waters of the harbour, and not from the walls around. Just before 3 o'clock, the Asgard came in under its naval crew, which was led by Lieutenant Deasy, a Waterford man, and it tied up at exactly the same point and at the same bollards as the Asgard herself had tied up 47 years ago in 1914, the same month of that year, July. She's a ketch-rigged boat. That means that she has a high mainmast in front and a small mast at the stern. It was to the top of the small mast that the principal part of the ceremony today was going to be concentrated, for there was going to fly the ensign, the green, white and orange tricolour as we know it, and that is also our naval ensign. As she tied up, I saw her commander, Lieutenant Deasy. I saw a number of petty officers and a number of ratings. Two of these ratings were holding the ensign, waiting for the order to raise it to the masthead. Astern of these ratings, right by the taffrail, were boxes clearly marked Hamburg, exactly the way the original boxes were marked when they arrived containing the rifles in July 1914. This is the man who tied up the Asgard when it arrived at Hoth in 1914. His name? Billy McConkey. Do you remember that day in July 1914?
I do, quite well.
What happened?
Well, there was only myself and the brother and my father here, and Tom Kettle originally, the day before, wanted us to go out to fish.
Yes.
And I was told, at least my father was told, that he wasn't going out to fish, he was going out for something else, and I was so young he wouldn't let me go. So she came in the next morning then, and I cut our ropes here.
What came in, the Asgard?
The Asgard, yeah. And then, in the meantime, there was about 400 or 500 men running down here to unload her and three taxis.
How old were you then?
I was about 15 and a half.
Yes. And you actually tied up the Asgard?
I did, yeah. Uh-huh. Yes.
Do you remember any other incident at that time?
Yes. I remember Miss Rice and Mrs. Childers with our sandwiches. They had two water bits and a plain slab of chocolate between them.
Next, to Captain Eamon Martin of Nafianna.
All the officers were well aware of the operation. Sometime before, Bulmer Hobson, who was vice president of the Fianna and who was in charge of the landing arrangements, informed our executive of the plan and of the part assigned to the Fianna. Anticipating trouble with the police, he had 200 oak battens made to be taken in our trek car to Hoth and distributed on arrival there.
Yes.
When the head of the volunteer columns reached the pier, there was a short halt to allow the Fianna with the trek car to go to the front. We then doubled down the pier, reaching the jetty just as the Asgard came alongside. Sean Houston, Lee Mellows and others jumped aboard, and soon the unloading was underway. Boxes of ammunition were loaded into the trek cart to its full capacity, the remainder of the ammunition being sent separately to Dublin by taxis and private cars. When the volunteers were intercepted at the junction of Malahide Road and Clontarf by police and military, Hobson engaged the Assistant Commissioner of Police, Harold, in dispute. When Darrell Figgis joined Hobson, he left him to continue the parley and the delaying tactics while he himself came back along the lines, ordering the volunteers to get back and disperse with our rifles. We took the trek cart back to our tane and concealed it in the grounds of the Redden family house, and we buried the ammunition there. Later that evening, working through the night until the early hours of Monday, Lee Mellows, Gary Houlihan, myself, with others of the Fianna and volunteers, retrieved quite a number of rifles which had been concealed in haystacks and barns in the North County. In the following days, we unearthed the ammunition and recovered the remainder of the rifles, some of which had been dumped in the grounds of Croydon Park, which is then owned by the ITGWU as a holiday resort.
Now to the voice of Rory Childers in conversation with Pat McGinley from Gola, who was recruited by Francis Joseph Bigger of Belfast.
I was up in our Glass County Down. I was driving a motorboat that time for a crew fishing up from our Glass over towards the Isle of Man, and he met me, Francis Joseph Bigger from Belfast, and he took me up to Belfast every Saturday after we got through, and took me back on Monday morning, and he was all the time promising me he would give me a good yacht ride in the summer, the next summer, see. So, of course, the next summer I was fishing. I had a crew and I was fishing away from home about 80 miles and we were boarding down there. And finally I got a wire from Mr. Bigger in Belfast and he told me to proceed there right away. Well, when I got there, the girl at the information desk told me that Mr. Bigger wasn't in, but there was a letter for me to give to me. So I took the letter and it was marked outside, proceed down to the Tilbury Docks in Belfast. At 8:30 that night, there was a steamboat leaving for Liverpool. And I was supposed to board it. And then to cross over across to the other side, Birkenhead, and I would meet the skipper of a yacht in the name of Erskine Childers. Well, I got over there okay, and we finally did meet. He knew me better than I did him because I had my sea bag on, you know, full of clothes and my belongings. And he asked me if I came across on the boat that morning. I said, yes. Were you looking for anybody? He said, yes, I was looking for a man in the name of Erskine Childers. I said, well, this is the man. I am him.
So
he took me down to where the boat was, down further down along the beach. And we started getting provisions in right away for the trip to Germany.
Did you notice, you at that time, you didn't know what the destination was?
No, no idea.
Yes.
I thought it was going to be a nice yacht ride.
You thought it was going to be a nice yacht ride,
yeah,
I see.
So it was.
Well, when you finally departed, did you have any other mate with you?
No, when I departed, he had a fella in there first, and I didn't like him very much because I could see that he wasn't a seaman to start with.
I see.
And then Mr. Childers asked me if I knew anybody, a good deep seafaring man that could know how to handle a boat.
Yes.
I said, yes, I got him. So that I left him on my boat when I left, you know, from Ireland going over to...
This was an old friend of yours.
Yeah, that's an old friend of mine. I know him ever since I was a kid. And I wired him to come to Liverpool and cross over, you know. And he wired back, he says he would be there, but it took him almost a week to get there. I don't know what held him up. And the next morning, about 4 o'clock, we heard the thump, thump, thump up on deck, you know. And here was Mr. Childers getting us up, you know, and hoist up anchor and start out. So we started out into the North Sea, and that's the first time that I knew it wasn't going to be a nice yacht ride. He says, boys, we are going over to the German side to pick up a cargo of rifles for the Irish Volunteers. As soon as we got sails made after leaving Isle of Wight into the North Sea, he told us to come aft, you know. And
yeah.
He was at the wheel that time himself, you know, because we were busy with the sheets and headers on the yacht. And he told us then that we were going to Germany for a cargo rifle for the Irish Volunteers. And if we were good and made good, we'd be pretty well rewarded for it. The wind wasn't very strong, you know, and I think it took us about 2 days to get over there. We reached there, it was Sunday evening, I know, just before dark, it was still daylight, and there was a lot of tugs going around there too, and they had, Mr. Childers had his glasses and he was looking up at the smokestack to pick up the signal, to pick up their name on the smokestack, you know.
Yes.
So he did, and he says, that's her over there, the one that we wanted. So we moved closer, you know, closer until we got over to her, and then we made the regular signals, you know, that we were the ones they were looking for.
Yes.
Then we pulled alongside and tied the yacht to a scam there, then tied the yacht alongside of the tug, and we started unloading. The German crew was taking them up from the hold from the German ship, and some on the side deck, and some reaching them down to me and my partner, and we were stacking them down below in the hold of our boat. Anyone looking at her would know that she was either sinking or she was loaded with contraband.
The voice of Pat McGinley, who passed away in Chicago in April of 1970 at the age of 75. All those voices are courtesy of the RT Radio Sound Archives from 1961. And given that Pat McGinley and Charlie Duggan were from Gola, this classic from Emmett Spiceland seems appropriate.
Spell me out.
Last weekend, the official opening of the new facility at Baltimore Sailing Club took place. A fortnight ago, prior to the Shirkin Island Regatta, Seascape spoke with the commodore of the club, Joan Collins.
It's a fantastic facility for the village. We're very proud of it. It's huge for visitors, for income for the village. I suppose where it's located is fantastic. It's right on the water. And we have events all year round. And it's, but now that we have these new facilities, state-of-the-art changing rooms, we've doubled our size in the function room. So we're looking forward to hosting a lot of national events. A huge amount of work went on. I suppose we realised a few years back it had to be re-roofed, rewired. Previous commodore to me, Tony O'Driscoll, came in and looked at the project and decided we'd be much better off to go ahead and do a decent job on the club and extend it, and that's where it started. We put word out, and the generosity of both our members and the local businesses was just huge. And as you know, a few years back there was a huge rescue of George David and the Rambler in the Fastnet race. A lot of our members would be lifeboat crew, fishermen. So there is, and as I said, as you mentioned there earlier about the junior sailors. At the moment, we have one of our junior sailors sailing in Lake Garda in the European Lasers. Last week, Skull Community College won the British Schools Nationals Helms by three of our members. So you can just have the wet room open, or if there is a function, we can keep the people that are sailing out, and we have everything ready here. We opened at Easter. It was our first event, the Laser Nationals, and it's been open every weekend since. We've had a group of marine archaeologists. It has been used locally by the Wooden Boat Festival, the O'Driscoll Clan Gathering. It's been used every weekend. Actually, every February, we have, for the last 3 years, we have the Opie Association, Irish Opie Association, come down here, and they love the situation. They can sit on the square, they can look down, they see it all going on in the harbour. So, and they're really looking forward to coming back next February to the newly refurbished club. But I was late coming to sailing. My husband, really, and family, they were all sailing. My husband would be very involved. He's a fisherman. He's involved in the lifeboat. My son is also involved in the lifeboat, and all belong to him. And I suppose even my own background, that my own family are seagoing people as well. I mean, it's all volunteers here. It's great community spirit, I suppose. I mean, when you think of it, the cost of this project was approximately 400,000. Of that, we got a grant of 150 from the West Cork Development Partnership, which we're very, very thankful for. And the rest, 250,000, a lot of that, most of that was raised from members and the local community. We're very lucky that we have two of our members who represented Ireland in the Olympics, Maria Coleman and Peter O'Leary. They're great for coaching the younger members, and each summer they give time and they coach them, and they give them huge encouragement. And I said, well, we're one of the first, I think, in the country to get the local schools involved. At Easter time, we had the school here from Baltimore and Shirkin Island, and we had a two-day sailing course for them. And again, once they broke up from school in June, we had a week-long course.
The Commodore of Baltimore Sailing Club, Joan Collins. You can see and read more about Baltimore Sailing Club on the Seascape's webpage. Also, there's a wonderful book recently published, Shirkin Island, A Local History by Dolly O'Reilly. Well worth checking out if you're making a visit to this gem of an island. Also recently published by Old Head Press is No Flowers on a Sailor's Grave, The Shipwrecks of Kinsale and Cormacsharry by Jerome Lorden, historian, mariner and maritime enthusiast. A fine addition to the canon of literature on our maritime history. Next here on Seascapes, to our Galway studios, where we can hear from Inshore Ireland features editor Gerry Flynn on what's in the latest edition.
Inshore Ireland's July issue reports and analyses two recent key developments that are sure to have a significant impact on the maritime sector. The first, our lead story, reports the unveiling of the government's long-awaited management plan for the inshore fisheries sector. This package of measures has been tailored specifically to reorganise and provide a voice for the 2,000-strong inshore fishing fleet and their coastal communities, a sector we describe in our editorial comment as numerically large but chronically disorganised and shamefully under-resourced. In an exclusive interview on page 9, the plan's architect, Minister Simon Coveney, responds to questions about its three core elements: a working forum, funding for environmentally friendly fishing practices, and conservation measures to support lobster and shrimp stocks. Rejecting our suggestion that the National Inshore Fisheries Forum might become just another talking shop, Minister Coveney is determined that won't happen. This plan is about providing proposals and policy options that represent good value for money to build this industry, and it provides fishermen with a really valuable opportunity to make their sector work, he says. On page 10, we speak to Michael Keating, Deputy CEO of BIM and its Director of Fisheries Development Services, about the mechanisms that might be employed to activate the new plan at local level. Acknowledging the failure of previous attempts to create a workable management framework for the inshore sector, Keating is optimistic this time, saying that he expects the National Inshore Fisheries Forum to work well at community level, possibly under the Flags umbrella. The fisherman's view is included too, with Francis O'Donnell, Chief Executive of the IFPO, welcoming the new measures as a starting point to sorting out the lack of management and policy in the inshore fishery. Pointing to the National Forum, O'Donnell sees its makeup as being critical to the plan's success or failure. He says it is imperative for inshore fishermen and women to be well represented. Some may be sceptical, but we need to give this plan a chance, and it will require buy-in from the sector, he says. Further evidence of government commitment to the sustainable development of Ireland's marine resources emerges in our coverage of the first annual conference of the Harnessing Our Ocean Wealth Strategy. We note that amongst the wider maritime community, it hasn't gone unnoticed that this major one-day conference included upbeat contributions from An Taoiseach and four of his cabinet colleagues, a level of ministerial attention never seen before in relation to Ireland's maritime sector. Our two-page interview with Dr. Peter Heffernan, CEO of the Marine Institute, also reinforces Harnessing Our Ocean Wealth as the essential framework that will enable Ireland to tap into a global marine market worth €1.2 billion for seafood, tourism, oil and gas, renewable ocean energy, and much more. Finally, budding entrepreneurs and existing seafood processors with ideas for a new product will find our report on page 18 on the successful first 5 years of the Seafood Development Centre in Clonakilty to be essential reading. Donal Buckley, Director of Business Development at BIM, provides a clear step-by-step overview as to how the SFD's state-of-the-art facilities can help to develop product ideas right through to market. This and much more in your July issue of Inshore Ireland.
Much has been written about the extended Wild Atlantic Way, celebrating our spectacular coastline, including Eugene O'Loughlin's Exploring Ireland's Wild Atlantic Way, a motorcycle odyssey, which is published by the Liffey Press. Here's a musical tribute from Francie Conway with Finbar Fury and Bianca Canaan. The recording has been released, coupled with the Lonesome Boat.
God bless the fishermen heading out to sea to fill the hold full of dreams for the love of his family. The Wild Atlantic Way has given us a home. Its rugged, majestic shoreline. The Wild Atlantic Way say farewell to the harbor. Hours before dawn, witness the sunrise reflecting our ancestors' eyes. The Wild Atlantic Way has given us a home. Its rugged, majestic shoreline. The Wild Atlantic Way.
Wild Atlantic Way, written by Francie and Rory Conway. Next week here on Seascapes, we have the remarkable tale of the Ouzel Galley and its voyage into the unknown with Kieran Devaney, Jerome Lorden on No Flowers on a Sailor's Grave. We hear about planned celebrations for the inventor of the submarine, John Philip Holland, in his native Liscannor in County Clare. We preview Calves Week, and in rowing, the Skull Regatta celebrates 130 years. All that and much more here on Seascapes. Until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.